What happens when two bass road warriors spend quality time talking music and life with one of their peers? Bassist, educator, author David C. Gross and bassist and head honcho of KnowYourBassPlayer.com, Tom Semioli, trade eights with the legends of rock, jazz, funk, blues, folk, country, and more. Notes from an Artist, revealing conversations with the legends who've created the soundtrack of our lives. What happens? You're about to find out. It's another episode of Notes from an Artist.
David, let me introduce our audience member to Ian Hunter in case they don't know who he is. He's a singer. He's a songwriter. He's a performing and recording artist. And in his spare time, he was the driving force behind one of rock's greatest ensembles, Mott the Hoople. We're here to discuss the new record, Defiance Part 2, which follows Defiance Part 1, which came out last year. Ian, why the subtitle Fiction on Defiance Part 2?
It was their suggestion. It was the last track that was written. It was written not long before we actually, it's the most recent one. Mm-hmm. And I took a while with it and they liked it. And they said, could we, you know, sort of sub Fiction onto the title? And I said, yeah, you know, why not?
Okay. Now Defiance 1 and 2 were recorded remotely. And I guess COVID had a lot to do with that. But, you know, listening to both these records, which work as a song cycle, sounds like you guys were all in the same room.
Well, these are intelligent people. You know, it's like a question of sending the right track to the right person, you know, or people.
Okay. If
there's any talent involved, it was doing that, you know, sending. I mean, Bed of Roses 117, Ringo's 117 governor.
Mm-hmm.
They send it to Ringo, you know. And back it comes. Yeah. It was a great experience. It still is, you know.
Now, Andy Rourke is your second in command. He's your co-producer. I guess, you know, he's sort of filling the role or actually bringing his own voice to the role that Mick Ronson played. Because I know when Mick passed, you took a couple of years sabbatical. And then you started hooking up with Andy. Talk about your relationship with him.
We went to Steve Holly rang me up and said, why don't you, I've been off for about 5 years or 6 years, something like that.
Hmm.
Why don't you do something? And I said, well, I don't really know anybody. And Steve Holly took me to this benefit. And in the afternoon, there was a three-piece. As I walked out after a sound check, there was a three-piece playing. And it was Andy. Andy was singing and playing lead with this three-piece. And I just thought, that guy's great. And I approached him, and he was right in the middle of, you know, the Mellencamp touring situation. So it was about a year before we got together.
Mm.
But slowly over the years, he's become indispensable, you know, because he's not only, especially in this situation, because he's not only a guitar player, he's a drummer, he's a bass player, and he also has a voice that can go anywhere, you know.
Mm.
So he's been, it's kind of like the one-off situation all over again. Well, initially, you know, the whole thing started with a photographer called Ross Halfin.
Okay. Who,
yeah, and my manager, Mike Kobayashi. And it was COVID. And they were saying, well, you know, these guys have got studios in their houses. And they ain't doing nothing. They're not on the road, you know. Maybe you should think about, like, doing something with these guys. It was Slash was first.
Right.
And Billy from ZZ, people were volunteering, and it just developed from there.
Now, among the reasons why we all love vinyl, old school records, is the album art. Tell me now, Johnny Depp did this cover based on a photograph, yes?
I've got up with John, you know, with the Vipers, and he's got up with me a couple of times, and he likes what I do, you know.
Right.
So we got involved. And if it hadn't been for John, Jeff Beck wouldn't be on both those records.
Right,
John was, John was with him at the time.
Right. Jeff, they were working on the album 18 together when I think they did your tracks, probably.
They toured, you know, yeah. And then, you know, Jeff, I met Jeff and we had a good night out, John and Jeff. And next thing you know, he's on the record. And being a 70s artist, the 60s guys were the gods, you know.
Sure.
So it was a huge buzz, especially with Beck, because he was Mick's idol. He was Ronno's idol.
Yes.
Mick
Now.
Ralph's idol, it was a huge honor for him to be on the record.
Yeah, and it's his last recorded work, I believe. Yes.
According to his manager, yeah, the third rail, yeah.
And aside from Pretty Girls, what does Johnny Depp bring to the table as a musician?
Aura. He got up with the Ram Band and they all said, he hangs back, he plays where he doesn't play, where he doesn't, where it's not needed, economical.
Now, it seems like the secret to a happy marriage is to write a song about your wife.
You've got it.
Now, you had Trudy's song, you had Knees of My Heart, and this one to Trudy is What Would I Do Without You? Tell me the story now. You and Overend are in the village, and Trudy was a waitress.
Yeah, and somebody told her I was a bit of a lad, so she told me to fuck off, and I was immediately attracted. 52 years later, we're still at it, and I'm damn sure I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for her.
But it's interesting that you had Lucinda duet with that. How did that come about?
Well, Trudy can only sing one note.
Oh, is
She
it?
whole song again. Once she doesn't go up, she doesn't go down. She just sings in one line. Lucinda. We needed a bit of professional help. Lucinda did it. She did it great. I mean, she's
Yes,
got
she
this
did.
gorgeous voice.
Yeah. What did Wasn't her husband a fan of Mott? I think that's how you guys got together.
How I met her was I played in Nashville.
Yeah.
And she came with her husband. Her husband probably got her to come. But she was great. She came back afterwards, and we had a chat. And so we asked her to come on this, and she did.
Yeah, and she recorded that remotely as well. Amazing.
Yeah. And the thing with a lot of these people is they're so generous that they don't just send one track, they send half a dozen.
Okay.
In her instance, it was like, this is where I think I should be, these are the lines I should do. But I'll do the whole song twice just in case, and take what you want and leave what you don't want, which makes our lives a lot easier,
Over the years, so many artists have interpreted your songs. Barry Manilow obviously had the hit with Ships. Alejandro Escovedo does your tunes. Great White had the hit with Once Bitten. What's the general impression you get when somebody, when you hear yourself translated in such a manner?
Well, in the case of Manilow, it was like listening to a different song, because he approaches things totally differently. He's going from an arrangement angle, a pop angle. He's modulating. I don't do that. So it was kind of interesting to see what he did with it. He took it into the pop arena.
Now. Going back, when you started with Mott, you were new to the craft of being a front man. You had a very Dylan-esque delivery. You had the persona. I think Brain Capers was the album when you really started to sound like Ian Hunter. Was that just part of the process of the fact that Mott just toured so heavily that you had to develop your own identity?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd been a bass player before I joined Mott. I joined Mott as a keyboard player and a singer.
You're right. That's right. Yes.
I don't know, it just sort of developed that way. And the songwriting, the same thing. I mean, the idea was Pete and Mick were going to do the songs. And then Pete couldn't be bothered.
Right.
This was before we knew that money was in the publishing. So Pete couldn't be bothered, And so I sort of developed and then. Guy Stevens, the manager at that time, was like, we need a front man. We need, Jagger's out there doing that. I mean,
Right.
so I came off the keyboard and went into the middle, started playing, CF and G. But I had been a bass player and like a harmony sort of singer. So when they put me in the lead spot, I figure I've got to go the Dylan route or the Sonny Bono route because they're character singers. I'm not really
Right.
a good natural singer. And so, yeah, I copped off Bob for a couple of years there, and thanks very much, Bob. And, you start developing your own thing as the Mott songs started to get written, and you get more used to going out live and all the rest of it. And slowly I moved to the middle and it developed from there. But it was all accidental. Nothing was planned. Well, Queen were planned. They were intelligent people. They planned. Mott never planned. It was just this glorious ball of fun, and everybody was, and it was awkward, and it was the Hereford Mafia and all that, but I loved it. I loved it. There's so many characters, you know.
Well, you started off as a bass player with Freddie Lee, right?
I played with Billy Fury. I played with Freddie Fingers Lee, for a while, actually. That's when I started thinking maybe I should do it for a living, because we were going to Germany and we were getting paid good money in Germany, Star Club, places like that. That's when I started to think maybe I'd like to do this, because I was just a fan before that.
Now, one of the great moments in bass history, David and I will attest to that, was All American Alien Boy. And I always thought, oh my God, I pity the bass player in the Ian Hunter band when Ian calls the tune. And of course, that happened with my dear friend Paul Page. And Paul and I, we meet a couple of times a month to have pizza at Arturo's on Houston Street. I don't know if you're familiar with that place.
I know how to straight, but yeah, go.
All right. So I love what he did. Rather than imitate Jaco, Paul brought his own voice to the song. And then you opened up with it. So you really put him on the spot. But what's your thoughts about Paul doing his own interpretation on that track?
Well, he did exactly what he should have done, and I never even thought about it. I just thought, Paul's a bass player. You do what. There's never been do this or do that with me. You're in the band, you do what you do. That's why you're here. And Paul, you couldn't wish for a nicer person. He's a great bass player. Could he do the Jaco solo? I don't know. We never even attempted it. It was Paul that was on the stage, not Jaco, And that was it. It never occurred to me. I didn't realize. I mean, Paul was going through it. I never realized. I just thought he'll do what he's going to do, you know.
Right. And it was a daunting task because, again, in 1976, when that record came out, that was really the first time the masses had heard Jaco. I mean, obviously, he had done a record with Pat Metheny, and then he did a record with Weather Report, which was on the same label. You're both on Columbia. But when that record came out, we looked at it like it was man discovering fire. We didn't know what we were hearing.
Well, I met him through Bobby Columbia, who was the drummer with Blood, Sweat and Tears. We had the same manager. And he was staying at Bobby's, and Bobby was kind of like auditioning him to all his jazz mates. And then Bobby rang me one day and said, "You've got to come and listen to this guy." And I started talking to him, and we got friendly. And in the end, he said to me, "I'm getting fed up with this sitting here auditioning to all these people." And I was just beginning, I was over the river. And I said, "Why don't you come and live with me while I'm doing this record? Do this record." And so it was just timing, really. He came and stayed with me. He rehearsed 8 hours a day, every day, because he'd been a drummer. And something had messed with his wrists. And so then he decided he would not be the best drummer in the world. He would be the best bass player in the world. And he calculated 3 years, 8 hours a day would make him the best bass player in the world. He'd been 21 then. And this is exactly what he did. And in my house for a month, 8 hours a day, that's what he did in the basement. And then we went down to Electric Lady. Couldn't afford to stay in the city. We just went down in a car every day and did All American Alien Boy, which actually messed my career up real bad. But I enjoyed doing it.
Yeah, it was a great artistic move, and of course, legend has it that that's Mick Ronson's favorite record of yours.
Yeah, it is.
In 2013, I was at the Canary Wharf Hotel in London before the last Mott gig, the original Mott gig, and I had an assignment from Huffington Post Books to interview Pete Watts, who had his only book out, The Man Who Hated Walking. And we were in the lobby, and Trudy Hunter says to me, "How did you get Pete to talk?" And before I could answer her, Ian Hunter says, "How did you get Pete to stop talking?" And
once you get him going, you know, Pete was on a roll. It was just getting him to go.
Well, it's funny because his handler, Peter Purnell of Angel Air, insisted that I ask no questions about Martha Hoople because Pete was sensitive to that. And I said, "I'm fine. It's a book interview. Campbell Divine wrote everything you need to know about Martha Hoople." So I sit down with Pete and he won't stop talking about Martha Hoople.
Yeah, right. Typical.
Typical. And he talks about Mott without the Hoople and British Lions. He goes through every album. And I'm like, Pete, who cares about Mad Shadows? We got to talk about the book. And so I think, you know, I said, hey, Pete, you got to get to a sound check. I think Pete is the man who hated to talk about the man who hated walking. That's what it was.
Pete was eccentric.
Yes.
A total eccentric and wonderful company, but he did have his blind spots, you know, which I'm not going to even discuss.
Thank you.